Alan Gring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 11, delivered on September 27, 2016. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates in Finance.
Tonight, Interest Rates in Finance. Now, I went through a special topics week talking about interest rates and things of that nature. And now this is where the book brings them up, not in the depth that I did, but they do bring them up. So I'm going to, some of this is going to be a review of what I did in the second week, and then I'm going to extend it a little bit in some directions. I'm going to give you a couple of definitions, and I might have already given them to you. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure I did, and a few that I did not before, and give you a couple of specific skill sets that might be useful to you in practical terms later in your lives. But right now, first things first, let me do it like this. Madam, you're going to need to borrow a grand for a year. What would you consider to be a reasonable interest rate? 5%? That's a little bit modest, but you know, that's that you're the consumer of the, yeah, I understand your position. That's okay. 5%, 8%, something like that in the area. Now, there's an interesting phenomenon, and there's been kind of a sharp debate in the last year or so. I joined in that. If I can find the article that was written on it, I will share it with you. I put a comment that got, and I got yelled at by some others who felt that I was being wrong or something. But here's the deal. You see, in the world of finance, in the world of consumer loans, business loans, and all that, and banking and financial planning, we have these ideas about what is considered to be a reasonable rate of return for investing in someone in lending instruments. So, for example, you are a very wealthy man. I mean, that white chino, right? Look at this. I mean, this is respect right there. I mean, you know, you look really good. And you're the kind of guy, well, yes, I'm going to save for retirement. I'm going to put aside $5,000 a year, and I will collect it when I am 60 years old. And I will get a return on my investment of maybe 5 to 7%, somewhere in that range, okay? That would be considered reasonable and rational for you to do that, okay? But the problem is we know that this is not the case for many, many people. Especially people who have been raised in lower classes or have experienced extreme poverty, they would see any possible return in the range of 5 to 7% as ridiculous. I'll spend my money now. I'm not going to put any money in the bank. Are you out of your mind? Absolutely not. 5%, and I don't even get to use it for 40, 60 years? No, I'm not going to live that long. I'm going to buy me a cheeseburger today and some potato chips and maybe something, maybe a movie on Redbox to watch. And you'll see these finance professionals who will say, well, obviously these people are all irrational and we have to force them to abide by normal rules of finance. And I came in and I said, you missed the entire point. There are actually two entirely different ways people calculate return versus calculate the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. They're the people who are in the normal range. They've got enough money so they can put some aside and they still have enough for all their fun. But then there are people who you can't offer them enough to give up what, to give up their money now. You just can't, unless it would be some staggering interest rate. Okay, now, let me take this as my background. Remember that an interest rate, as I showed you, an interest rate starts with the risk-free rate, which comprises the real rate of return plus an expected inflation premium. Now, this real rate of return represents the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. Otherwise, I could say, well, this represents, there are different things you could talk about. But quite honestly, unless you are willing to say that people, that all of these lower class people are just irrational, and we've got to shepherd them and punish them when they don't do what we want, we have to recognize that there really isn't a single opportunity cost of foregone consumption. There are several. There's the opportunity cost of foregone consumption when you have plenty of money and you can forego some of that money and the consumption of it. And then there are those for whom the opportunity cost of giving up money now is insanely high. You're not going to do it. I just want to make sure you understand that. That everything that I teach you in this class is relative to the frame of Western capitalist finance. Now we're going to go on here. That's important later in the course. I make sure you understand. Okay, plus we have this thing called a risk premium. A risk premium. And that comprises three pieces. There is the default premium, the maturity premium, and the illiquidity premium. And I talked about those in class. Those are great for an essay question on a written in-class exam. Hint, hint. Nudge, nudge. Wink, wink. In other words, I'm telling you, know these things. These are the kinds of things that I ask on my in-class exam. Listen, explain the three components of the risk premium. That kind of question is my favorite. You either know it and you answer it in two sentences, or you don't know it and you go five times around the barn to get to the outhouse and I use my bullshit stamp on you. And I do have, I just got it re-inked. Because I care. Okay, the risk premium. Now, a couple of other things that I want to bring up, and I've talked about some of these before. Liquidity. Liquidity is the ease with which one asset can be converted into another asset. Liquidity is the ease with which one asset can be converted into another asset. So, in other words, this is highly liquid. You can turn this into a sandwich at Chick-fil-A instantly. That's highly liquid. Okay? Cash is considered the most liquid. Very close, a close substitute is a treasury bill because it would be accepted anywhere. However, it didn't work out for you the way you thought it would. You ended up having a trailer on the east side of Rockford. It's a good neighborhood. It's just not the best neighborhood. But now you want a sandwich. And you decide you're going to go and get one. Now, are you going to be able to turn your trailer into a sandwich right away? No, you can't do it. It's illiquid. But it is still an asset. So that would be an illiquid asset. Now, I shan't touch you, but imagine that I'm going to take you and I'm going to move you around. Now, I'm moving him around. You hear?
Yeah.
Listen. No, I want to make sure he hears. I'm moving you around, okay? Do you hear him?
Yeah.
Do you hear bloop, bloop? You do not. Don't lie. You don't. He's not liquid. Concentrate, boy. He is not liquid. You see, he is going to become money over time, but it's going to be a slow process with him. He is worth $6 to $10 million. No, you're not. Oh, yeah, you are. Honestly, but the point, though, is that you are all extraordinarily valuable assets. The funniest thing is that I talk to these people who are fund managers, and they, well, you want to work for us. You know, you could be handling all these millions and billions of dollars. I said, you have no idea. Every semester, I am handling probably close to $1 billion in assets, developing them, managing a portfolio. Far more important than all those stupid paper securities you guys do. But it's slow. These things grind out over time. Your value is extracted through your productivity and through the development of that productivity in skill sets that we teach you and that you teach yourself and the efforts that you make to become a better worker. So, in other words, you are extraordinarily valuable assets, but you are highly illiquid assets. It takes a long time, over a long period of time, the value comes out of you. But here's the interesting thing, is that liquidity, you can talk about high liquidity, or you can talk about low liquidity. Now, the low liquidity assets, generally speaking, okay, let me turn that around. High liquidity assets are, generally speaking, the ones that are securities. They don't have much of a presence in reality, and that's where I got to get into money here. The low liquidity assets are more likely to be physical, to have a physicality to them. You, someday you'll be dead and you'll be a ghost, okay? And then I'll hunt you. You know I have a ghost hunting club here, right? No, seriously, I do. If you can scream like a maniac and make Scooby-Doo sounds, you're in, and we can go ghost hunting. Okay, but for now, you're physical. Later, you'll be a ghost. Now, does a ghost make money? Have you ever seen a ghost? No, he doesn't. But as a physical thing, you will make money. Okay? The physicality generates a lot of return. But again, that probably means that it's going to be a low liquidity asset, like a factory or a new fleet of trucks or something along the line of a new product that is being developed. And that's the problem, is that the low liquidity probably is going to mean that you can make more out of it in the long run. The high liquidity means that you can use it right away to pay bills or whatever. But that also means that you're not going to make a whole lot out of it. And that's one of the things that we look at when we're looking at financial statements, those balance sheets. We look at the relative liquidity of the company, and we say if it's too low, well, we get worried that the company's not going to be able to pay its current bills. But if it's too high, we're saying, why aren't you putting that into things that could make money for you? I showed you Netflix. Netflix borrowed a lot of money long term, but it's just sitting there in cash right now. We're beginning to wonder, are you going to use this money here sometime soon? Or are you just going to sit there and let it earn 0.001% in some money market account? That's the next thing. You're going to see me, hear me now, and I've sort of been doing this, but I've kind of been loose on it. Make a distinction between a money market and a capital market. A money market is where funds that you need for less than a year are acquired. A money market is where funds that you need less than a year are acquired. So in other words, do you remember me talking about commercial paper? Okay, commercial paper is that very short 30-day borrowing by very large credit-worthy corporations when they need just money for something for 30 days. That, the market where they get that money from lenders, very wealthy lenders. That is a money market. When I go to the bank and I say, all right, I've got to build my inventory for the art shows that are starting in the spring, and then I'll pay it off through the art season in the spring, fall, spring, summer, and fall. That would be, I would be accessing money from funds from the money market. But if I am a company that borrows, let's say, $1 billion on, let's say, 20-year bonds, my corporation would be accessing funds from the capital market, not from the money market. If I sell stock to raise money, that most definitely comes from the capital market, because that money is forever money. That money is gone forever, absorbed into that company. Okay, so that would be capital. I'm accessing the capital markets that way. When you borrow money for your student loans, you are accessing money that is in the capital markets. Now, let me give you a little bit of a background on this. You see, when nations trade, if I trade, you're Canada. We buy oil from Canada. A lot of our oil comes from Canada. We will pay you in U.S. dollars. Now, your producers of the oil don't get those U.S. dollars. They get Canadian dollars. You, the Canadian government, through your central bank, get the U.S. dollars. And you put those into your foreign reserve, and then you give your oil producers the Canadian equivalent. Okay? That would be a money market transaction. You are a Chinese producer of consumer goods, like toasters and all that. What would happen in that there is that I, as an American consumer, would pay American dollars to the Central Bank of China, which would then pay you in the local currency, the yuan. And then you would hold those money market transaction funds. Money, just quick money. I bought a toaster, okay? Then the reflection of that comes back through in the long run, because you, the Central People's Bank of China, you, the Central Bank of Canada, you cannot spend those American U.S. dollars anywhere else in the world except in the United States. That's the way currencies work. So what you do is you invest those in long-term assets here in the United States. You lend us money for our government debt. You lend us money for our student loans. You lend us money for our cars and our homes. Capital market transactions that arose from funds that flowed in the money markets. Most people don't know that. But the reason that we run these massive trade deficits is simply because that way we can get our funds back lent to us in the capital markets. That's how we can afford to have very low tax rates in this country. That's how we can afford to have lots of programs and great wars, two theater wars at the same time, that kind of great fun stuff, is because we can buy stuff from overseas in the money markets, transact there, and then that money comes back to us in the capital markets, lent to us in the long run, or used to buy our corporations through stock purchases and all that. Okay, now, the equivalent of that in the corporate world is when people buy consumer products or services. Those occur as money transactions at the revenue line. And then as all the bills are paid, and then down there at the bottom line, that residual income, some is paid as dividends, but the rest is reinvested into capital projects of the company for long-term returns to the investors. So it begins at the top of the financial statement, at the top of the income statement, as a money market transaction. Then whatever's left down there at the bottom after you pay your bills and all that, that belongs to the shareholders. You give some as dividend, but the rest is invested into these low liquidity projects. Some of it is put into the high liquidity cash at the balance sheet, but a lot of it goes in a lot lower down there in the long-term fixed assets on the balance sheet. And I really don't expect you to get that totally. If you do, that's absolutely awesome. But the idea there is, though, that this gives you another completely different view of what financial statements are, and what a company is, and how companies and sovereign governments are all very much similar to each other. There is this cycle of money and capital that is what keeps our world running. That it's what keeps the capitalist system running. Very cool thing, and it's happening in this amazing multi-trillions and quadrillions of dollars and other funds all the time, flowing in the hustle and flow around the world 24/7. Very cool stuff. Now, money. And I've done this one too, but I got to make sure that we got this one on the table. Three kinds. Got to find someone. I'm not paying enough attention here. Sir, I make apple pies. You, sir, does he look like Bear Grylls? Grylls? Does he? No, he doesn't. Okay, but you're a moose hunter. You hunt moose, okay? Now, you come to me and you like pie. You really like pie. Are you into the TV show Supernatural? Dean Winchester, and he loves pie. Never mind. Okay, but you love my apple pies. And I actually like moose. I don't. My father used to come back from Canada. He hunted moose. You know what moose tastes like? Moose. No, literally. When you eat it, your whole face fills with moose. He stopped doing that once when a bull moose finally had enough of his crap and beat him up. Who knew? A moose can pick you up with those big things. It wasn't Bullwinkle at all. He tossed my dad around something fierce. But anyway, try to stay with the story here. Listen. Okay, you're going to come to me, and you have moose. I have pie. And we trade. I get moose, you get pie. Is the moose currency? And you don't necessarily have to say yes or no. You could qualify it.
I say yeah.
Okay. The answer is yes if there is a general acceptance of moose in trade. If you could say, well, he takes moose and I get from him, what do I get? What do you get from him? Oh, God, don't say his daughter. He'll kill you. I know. Obviously. Very, very nice pantaloons. I mean, they were not common until he started making them for men. Before that, we were wearing those togas. Those are very difficult in combat. Trust me. But anyway, listen. The point is that the moose is being accepted generally. Maybe not everyone. You're very precious. I don't take moose. I take only gazelle. Okay, but if there's a general acceptance of it, then I can say this is genuinely a currency. It doesn't have to be everyone takes it, but most people will. Interestingly enough, now there are some places that won't take, we won't take $100 bills. That doesn't mean $100 bills aren't currency. They are, but it's just that it has to be a general acceptance. So now, the first one is moose. Moose would be a barter currency. Barter. The important point about a barter currency is that it has full intrinsic value. He can trade that for pie, or he can eat the moose and use the antlers for a hat rack. And I don't know what else you can do with a, you know, moose fur. I don't, maybe, you know, give that to a girl he's fancies. You know, that would be a winning thing. You ought to try that. Seriously. You know, go on Snapchat. First girl who talks to me gets moose fur. Okay, now the barter. Full intrinsic. You can use it for currency to trade, or you can consume it fully. Or almost fully. The next kind of money would be a metal money, or sometimes we call it a commodity money. A commodity money has intrinsic value, but not as much. So, for example, gold is a commodity money. You can use it. There are things that gold is great for. There are a lot of things that gold isn't great for. Gold happens to be a very soft metal, so it has, and it's very pretty, and that makes it fairly useful. But there are other metal monies throughout history. For example, copper, nickel, platinum, all kinds of different metals are tradable, and they have intrinsic value, but not full intrinsic value. So in other words, I can find, and they're literally, you can find these arrowheads from medieval times that you can see marks that they were a coin, and someone took the coin and beat it into an arrowhead or a spearhead. But they don't have full intrinsic value. That's a commodity money. The next one is a fiat money, or a fiat money, depending on how you want to pronounce it. A fiat money has almost, virtually no intrinsic value. It is money only by decree of the sovereign. You will do this because the sovereign, the king, the government, whatever it is, the lord and master, they say it is money. So, in other words, in this regard, can you read that to me right there?
This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private.
Legal tender. In other words, if you don't accept it, you're breaking the law. So that means that I have to accept this. Now, it has virtually no intrinsic value. Yes, you could probably use it for toilet paper, but why? When you've got Charmin. Seriously, the bears like Charmin. You try to give this to a bear, here, use it for toilet paper, he'll eat you. He'll claw you and toss you around like they did in that movie. That guy, Leonardo DiCaprio, he was thrown around because he offered this instead of toilet paper Charmin to the bear. They didn't show that part of it. Weirdo. Okay, that's fiat money. There's another one that has zero intrinsic value. No question, it has nothing at all. This, I can actually use this. I told you about the guy who lit a cigar with it. You can wipe your nose with it. You can use it for toilet paper. You can even make a paper airplane out of it. Okay, great. There is the final level. The final level is the cryptocurrencies. The cryptos. The most famous of them is Bitcoin, but it is by no means the only one. They exist only in cyberspace. There is nothing to them except their cyberspace. And I know I'm probably repeating myself, but last year I had a couple of hashers come to talk about Bitcoin and give you the concept. It takes a while to get your mind around what in the world this is. It's not like these at all. Explaining a crypto to someone who has never heard of them or just knows normal currencies, and you're thinking, I don't understand what's going on. What's a hash? What's a hasher? What is a decryption? Why are you using massive gaming computers to hash for bitcoins? Why are they using so much electricity? Why is there any payoff to all of this? But there is, and that's the whole world of the cryptocurrencies. They go up and down. Now, interestingly enough, cryptos, back in the early 1990s, there was an effort by... There were a couple of efforts to start cryptos back in the 1990s, early. But the problem was, back then, the internet was still very young. Pretty much only geeks and nerds still knew about it. We'd been working in something that was essentially the internet for some years before that. But the internet took off, I think it was Amazon.com or someplace like that, started with a crypto. I wish I could remember. I froze on this morning in lecture. It was something like a backpack wallet or something like that. They tried to do their own custom proprietary crypto in the early 1990s. Didn't work. No one trusted the thing whatsoever. It couldn't possibly make any sense to use something like that. But now It's getting there. It goes up and down. Governments are trying to get control of it, to regulate it, and the dark web is just saying, no, you're not. You're not going to do this. And a few crypto writers have been taken and put in prison doing the work, but it's past what governments can possibly stop. But it's going to take years for it to develop to the point where... Does anyone in here have any bitcoins? Okay, good. They're not ready for prime time yet. But if you're interested, let me know. I'm going to bring in some hashers again this semester. And if there's enough interest, I'll take you all who are interested, I'll take you to a hasher's den. There's actually a den in not too far from here where you'll actually see hashing going on. The search, the hunt for bitcoins, the encryption, looking for the encryption and all that is going on. So if you're interested in that, let me know after class today, and I'll tell them how many people are going to come to it. They got lots of nice brochures. They're very good at explaining it carefully and slowly. They'll bring in some people from some of the heavy places up in Chicago and Canada they did last time. So we'll see what we can do if you're interested. Okay, anyway, let me get off that. Okay. What's all this mean? You got money. Notice that the barter money is not as liquid as the fiat. Crypto is so liquid, it's just boom, it's there and gone. Fiat money is highly liquid. The two kinds are considered almost perfect substitutes, not quite perfect substitutes, are cash and U.S. Treasury bills. There are some other close, very short-term instruments of other governments that are also extremely liquid as well. The difference between, actually, honestly speaking, the only difference between cash in your pocket and a U.S. Treasury bill is just purely in terms of that one step that you would have to take to turn a Treasury bill into money to get food. With money, you can get food instantly. With a treasury bill, it would just take the blink of an eye to turn it into money in your bank account. But still, there would be a little bit of a glitch step in there. That's why, even though they're both M1 money, cash is king still to this day. Commodity money. Well, yeah, but gold is liquid. If you had a gold coin... You go to Wendy's, go to the drive-thru. Yeah, I want a double cheeseburger, ketchup only, and no, I don't want your fries because you don't bother to peel your fries anymore, but you charge me more because they're supposed to be healthier, you lazy son of a bitch. So why don't you just give me a Frosty, chocolate, none of that fancy modern neo-vanilla stuff, okay? And you pull up and you've got a gold coin. You say, here. Do you know what a gold coin looks like? Would you trust him to say this is really a gold coin? Yo, you could scratch it and it could be one of those chocolate dollar things underneath it. I know, I would, you know, chocolate. Are you kidding? Dark chocolate, yes. Okay, but the point there is gold might seem like a very valuable thing. I mean, you're not going to turn that into a sandwich very easily. You're going to have to go to a place. And if you go, all right, I found a bar of gold. Have you ever had a dream where you found something like a bar of gold? Well, think about it. What would you do? You have a bar of gold. You've got bills to pay. You got lots of things you need money for. What are you going to do? Now that you have a bar of gold, just pay your bills?
Now you'd have to get it extremely expensive.
Exactly.
And the rate can fluctuate. So.
So you're going to have to go, first of all, the speculative aspect going up and down, but you're also going to find out that if you take it to, you see those places, we buy your gold? Yeah, at like 50% of what it's worth. That's what you do. That means it's highly illiquid because you're going to be punished for trying to exchange it. Plus, you're probably going to have, as soon as you put that gold bar on the counter at some gold exchange place, you're going to have IRS agents in black helicopters rappelling down to find out where you got that gold. Okay? Risk is going to be involved. The fluctuation in exchange rate that you brought up is going to be involved. Plus, the fact that the intermediary is going to ding you hard for that gold. That's not a liquid instrument at all. It's not, gold is not liquid at all. And barter, how easy is it going to be for you to carry that moose? I'm not going to go and get that moose. You're going to bring it to me. I made pie, okay? Do you know how hard it is to peel apples? So I expect you to bring me that moose. Have you ever carried a moose? Well, yeah, I mean, that would be a kind of a new sport, you know, moose carrying or something like that. But anyway, so the point there being, though, that barter money is highly illiquid. Okay. Now, let me take you away from this to the last thing for this evening. This goes to a story. To start this, I'll need to share with you something. I had already told you about the 1800s. It was just a wild west in finance. Scams were everywhere. Banking, fraud, investment pyramid schemes. I mean, even some very reputable people got caught up in some of these and put their reputations on the line and destroyed people that trusted them, not realizing what was going, how they'd been suckered into scams. A good example of that was General Ulysses S. Grant. He talked a lot of Civil War soldiers into pledging their pensions, and they lost everything thanks to him. That was thousands and tens of thousands of soldiers, veterans, lost their money in Ulysses S. Grant's scam, and he didn't even know it was a scam. They just used his name on the scam paper. But anyway, we put the Federal Reserve into place to try to get this Wild West under control. Now, for a while, things were different because there was this window in the 19-teens when you had a much more reformist government playing its hand. It had strengthened antitrust laws to try to break the backs of monopolies. It had gotten more actively involved in foreign affairs, trying to create a United Nations kind of thing called the League of Nations that kind of fell apart. Ended up, we got dragged into the Great War, later called the World War I. But there was an effort to reform and to fix and to get these scoundrels under control. Well, that all went by the wayside by the end of the 19-teens. Then the 1920s came along, and we had, again, the Wild West. The best government money could buy and no regulation. The best regulation is no regulation. Free markets are everything. If there is a defect, the market will correct itself. And so the 1920s became the Roaring 20s. And there were all these investment scams and schemes going along. I'll share one with you because it's relevant to what's coming. Okay, I have got an investment for you, sir. You put $10,000 into my plan, and in a year, you will have $14,000. That's a 40% return on your money. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking this can't be right. Well, I tell you right now, it is right, sir. My plan is unique, and I say unique, and I'll bet little green apples you'll agree, because my plan doesn't have just one, two, or three tens. It has four tens, 40% on your money. That's right, sir. You invest today, and if you don't want to invest today, well, I'll just walk across to this young man right here. What do you say, sir? And you're going to do it, because you're a sucker. You're unsophisticated, but I'm not sharing this, giving this to everyone, but you're the kind of person that understands these kinds of investments, and I'm going to make sure that you have a chance to get on the ground floor of this. 40% return in a year. Okay, he goes in. So what I do now is as I near a year, I'm going to owe him $14,000. And I'll, sir, I have got the investment of the century for you. $20,000, and I will return you not $25,000, not $28,000, not $30,000. I will return you $40,000 on your $20,000 investment. You invest today for $20,000, and you will earn 100%. And I'm not doing this with everyone. I sure wouldn't do it with these people because these people don't understand that kind of stuff. But you, sir, you are the kind of investor who is sophisticated, special. So you put $20,000 in, I give you your $14,000, I pocket $6,000, and then I go to you. Good morning there, you sucker, or you wonderful guy. I need $100,000, and I will return to you $500,000 in 1 year. That is not 100% return, 200% return, 300%. No, that's not even 400% return. I am offering you 500% return if you will put your money in, and you will go for it. Of course you will, because you think you're special. Just like Bernie Madoff's investors cried crocodile. He screwed us. Well, what did you expect? He was offering you returns no one else was getting. And you were just special because you were special. Bernie said you were. You see, and then I'll take your money and I'll pay you off and then I'll go on with the scam. These were pyramids, one after the other. And then once I couldn't pay, I was already on a very nice boat, luxury liner, to another country to start over again. Well, the crash happened of 29. Banks collapsing everywhere. These schemes and scams fell apart overnight all over the place. A lot of decent people lost their shirts, lost their life savings. No one jumped off buildings. That was a myth, but still, it was bad. And then we got to 1932, the first presidential election after the Great Crash, and the Great Depression was setting in. And it was, again, it was between Herbert Hoover, who had already shown his ability to run the economy into the ground, and a radical reformer and his slate of congressional candidates named Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And there were a couple of things that led up to it. It wasn't just the Great Depression or the crash of 29. There was a horrendous incident where a bunch of starving veterans from World War I who thought they were going to get a bonus, didn't get their bonus, so they camped in Washington, and they were attacked by federal troops under the orders of a later to be a great quote-unquote hero named Patton, who just charged into them with his cavalry and chopped at them with swords. But it was just gross and ugly. In 32, they kicked all the rascals out. We voted them all out of office, and we put into office reformers like you will not believe. Nothing like what we see today reform. They reformed labor laws. They reformed securities laws, Securities Act of 1933, the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. You'll learn more about those in this course. They reformed all of the Federal Trade Commission was reformed to make it a stronger, to make its authority stronger. And they reformed banking with the Glass-Steagall Act. The Glass-Steagall Act. Now, Glass-Steagall, interestingly enough, was repealed at the end of the 1990s. Why did we repeal Glass-Steagall that put reins on banks? Oh, because banks said, we can regulate ourselves. We don't need the government to regulate us. We can be self-policing, which was exactly what they said in the 1920s. Okay, anyway, one of the things that Glass-Steagall did was to put a cap on interest rates that banks could charge. Here's 5.25%. Now, if you remember from your economics class, this would be called a price ceiling. But it was an ineffective price ceiling because interest rates weren't that high. In the Great Depression, the government was printing money hand over fist. Supply of money goes down, the rental rate of money. Supply of money goes up, the rental rate of money goes down. So money was very, very cheap. So a cap of 5.25%, no reputable bank was going to complain about that because they didn't need to offer anything close to that kind of a rental rate. But it was there on the books. You can't charge more than 5.25%. Okay. Well, as once the economy finally scrambled back, it had a secondary recession in 35, 36. But then we began to pick up speed, and we got the war machine going, and we started our run in the South, in the Pacific theater against Japan, the Imperial Army, and then later against the Nazis in Europe. And our economy picked up, strengthened. Interest rates began to rise, as they would capital investment borrowing by both the government and by the private sector. The Federal Reserve began to claw back the liquidity, which brought interest rates up. And so at some point, banks began to feel a pinch because it couldn't offer more than 5.25%, but there were other investments that were no riskier that could because they were not regulated by Glass-Steagall. It wasn't severe, but it was enough that the banks had a problem. Now, the trick that they used had been known for a long time, but no one would use it. But here's how it works. Let me show you something. Invest $100 for 1 year at 5.25%. compounded annually. Well, what you would get is the future value would be $100 times 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 1 compounding per year to the 1 times 1, which would give you $105.25. Now, this looks awfully trivial, what I'm about to do. Now, divide that by your original investment, $100, and you get 1.0525. Now you subtract 1, and you get 0.0525, which is, not surprisingly, 5.25%. But watch what happens if I say, if I compound it semi-annually. Well, are you sure we can do that, Jim? Well, look at Glass-Steagall. Do you see anywhere where we can't compound semi-annually? Well, no, I guess I don't see that. Well, okay. Well, let's see. Compound it semi-annually. You would have the future value 100 times 1 plus 0.0525 over 2 to the 2 periods times 1 year. And if you do that, my phone's out of juice, so I'm going to have to do this on a calculator here. Seriously? Okay. Okay, I want a scientific calculator. Good. Yeah, there's a calculator. Okay, so I'll do 100 times, open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 2, close the parentheses, and raise that. Really? Y to the X. Where's my Y to the X? To the, open parenthesis, 2 times 1, close parenthesis, $105.31.89 3189-0625. Okay? Now, divide that by 100. Watch what happens. And I get 1.0531890625. And I'm carrying this out quite a few decimal places. Watch it, for God's sake. That Pearson system is so touchy about rounding error and all that. Have you seen that yet? You'll miss by just a little bit. Oh, you're wrong. Well, you know, bitch, I did it to 10 decimal places. No, I've done it too. I mean, how could I be wrong? Oh, you wanted 18 decimal places. Excuse me. But anyway, okay, so I'm going to subtract 1, and I get 0.053189-0625. Okay, so now, that means look what happened to the actual rate. The effective rate is above the stated rate. The effective rate has gone above the stated. They're still within the law, but they have done essentially a finance trick. It's not actually really a math trick, but it's a finance math trick to cause the effective rate to rise above the actual rate. Not much for this one, but still, that's all you need to begin to be able to break free of a price ceiling that has become effective. So now the quick, dirty formula to do this is do it this way. You do one effective rate. To get the effective rate, or the effective yield, you can call it either one. The effective rate, 1 plus the annual rate, divided by the number of compoundings per year, to the number of compoundings per year. Don't worry about the number of years. You don't need to know that. And then you minus 1. Subtract. Don't forget to subtract the 1, for God's sake. But that's how you get the effective rate. Now, you can do it for, if I said, well, we can go to monthly. You would use 12. You take the annual rate divided by 12, and you raise it to the 12th power, and then take the result minus 1. Daily, 365. Now, you can even do, there's another formula that's actually completely different. If you are really, really got a lot of money, there are these accounts that can compound, not semi-annually, not quarterly, not weekly, not daily. They compound instantaneously. And it's a completely different formula. It uses the natural constant E and all that kind of weird stuff. But you're not going to see those in your lifetime. I'm pretty much sure, guarantee that none of you are going to be that rich that you would be able. You could try, go to the bank and say, I will settle for nothing less than instantaneous compounding. And, you know, he'll look at you very sincerely. He'll say, Okay, so enough of that. Okay, that's the effective rate. There is a downside to this, because this is when you are an investor. But what happens when you are the borrower? When you are the lender, in other words, you're putting money into a bank account, you get the positive effect of this rate increase. But if you are the borrower, then it goes the other way. You decide that you want to buy a car with monthly payments for 5 years, and it doesn't matter how many years, but monthly payments, and they're offering you 6.89%. That's what it says in the ad on TV. 6.89%. And you, sir, can own a Ford F-150. That's right. You may not even ever be able to get a girl, but at least you'll have a big truck. Okay. So, well, let's look at what happens with monthly payments. The effective rate of that loan is 1 plus 0.0689 over 12 to the 12th power minus 1. So we would, in that case, say 1 plus 0.0689 divided by 12, close the parenthesis, to the 12th power. Minus 1, 7.11% is the effective rate on the loan. And notice that it gets worse. Well, I want to pay my payments every 2 weeks. You would actually make the effective rate of the loan worse. Isn't that perverse? Now, by law, they actually have to show you this rate. It has to be there in the contract somewhere. But, I mean, most people don't even notice it. I swear. Well, I don't know what that is. I know. All I know is I'm getting 6.89. Well, the reason they're going to put 6.89, 6.95, 6.99 is because they know that they can put it under because the effective rate would bump it above the next into the next whole number digit. So they can make it look like it's a loan that is in the 6% range when actually, effectively, it's a loan in the 7% range. And like I said, if you choose to do your loan payments biweekly, or you choose to do loan payments every week just because you're a responsible kind of person, and this would be the same thing that's true with a home mortgage. I want to make 2 payments a month on my home mortgage. You're actually jacking up the effective rate on your loan by doing that. So there's a comforting thought to you and something you've learned tonight from this course. That's all I have for you. I thank you.